the monk who sold his Ferrari. The wake-up call. He collapsed right in the middle of a packed courtroom. He was one of his country's most distinguished trial lawyers. He was also a man who was well known for the $3,000 Italian suits, which draped his well-fed frame, as for his remarkable string of legal victories. I simply stood there, paralyzed by the shock of what I had just witnessed. The great Julian Mantel had been reduced to a victim and was now squirming on the ground like a helpless infant, shaking and shivering and sweating like a maniac. Everything seemed to move in slow motion from that point on. "My God, Julian's in trouble," his paralegal screamed, emotionally offering us a blinding glimpse of the OVs. The judge looked panic-stricken and quickly muttered something into the private phone she had had installed in the event of an emergency. As for me, I could only stand there, dazed and confused. "Please don't die, you old fool. It's too early for you to check out. You don't deserve to die like this." The bailiff, who earlier had looked as if he had been embalmed in his standing position, leaped into action and started to perform CPR on the fallen legal hero. The paralegal was at his side, her long blonde curls dangling over Julian's ruby red face, offering him soft words of comfort, words which he obviously could not hear. I had known Julian for 17 years. We had first met when I was a young law student, hired by one of his partners as a summer research intern. Back then, he'd had it all. He was a brilliant, handsome, and fearless trial attorney with dreams of greatness. Julian was the firm's young star, the rainmaker in waiting. I can still remember walking by his regal corner office while I was working late one night and stealing a glimpse of the framed quotation perch on his massive oak desk. It was by Winston Churchill, and it spoke volumes about the man that Julian was. "Sure, I am that this day we are masters of our fate, that the task which has been set before us is not above our strength, that it pangs and toils are not beyond my endurance. As long as we have faith in our own cause and unconquerable will to win, victory will not be denied us." Julian also walked his talk. He was tough, hard-driving, and willing to work 18-hour days for the success he believed was his destiny. I heard through the grapevine that his grandfather had been a prominent senator and his father a highly respected judge of the federal court. It was obvious that he came from money and that there were enormous expectations weighing on his Armani-clad shoulders. I'll admit one thing, though. He ran his own race. He was determined to do things his own way, and he loved to put on a show. Julian's outrageous courtroom theatrics regularly made the front pages of the newspapers. The rich and famous flocked to his side whenever they needed a superb legal tactician with an aggressive edge. His extracurricular activities were probably as well known. Late night visits to the city's finest restaurants with sexy young fashion models, or reckless drinking escapades with rowdy band of brokers he called his demolition team, became the stuff of legend at the firm. I still can't figure out why he picked me to work with him on that sensational murder case he was to argue that first summer. Though I had graduated from Harvard Law School, his alma mater, I certainly wasn't the brightest intern at the firm, and my family pedigree reflected no blue blood. My father spent his whole life as a security guard with a local bank after a stint in the Marines. My mother grew up unceremoniously in the Bronx. Yet he did pick me over all the others, who had been quietly lobbying him for the privilege of being his legal gopher on what became known as the mother of all murder trials. He said he liked my hunger. We won, of course, and the business executive who had been charged with brutally killing his wife was now free man, or as free as his clattered conscience would let him be. My own education that summer was a rich one. It was far more than a lesson on how to raise a reasonable doubt where no one existed. Any lawyer worth his salt could do that. This was a lesson in the psychology of winning and a rare opportunity to watch a master in action. I soaked it up like a sponge. At Julian's invitation, I stayed on the firm as an associate, and a lasting friendship quickly developed between us. I will admit that he wasn't the easiest lawyer to work with. Serving as his junior was often an exercise in frustration, leading to more than a few late night shouting matches. Leading to more than a few late night shouting matches. It was truly his way or the highway. This man could never be wrong. However, beneath his crusty exterior was a person who clearly cared about people. No matter how busy he was, he would always ask about Jenny, the woman I still call my bride, even though we were married before I went to law school. On finding out from another summer intern that I was in financial squeeze, Julian arranged for me to receive a generous scholarship. Sure, he could play hardball with the best of them, and sure, he loved to have a wild time, but he had never neglected his friends. The real problem was that Julian was obsessed with work. For the first few years, he justified his long hours by saying that he was doing it for the good of the firm, that he planned to take a month off and go to the Caymans next winter for sure. As time passed, however, Julian's reputation for brilliance spread and his workload continues to increase. His cases just kept on getting bigger and better, and Julian, never one to back down from the good challenge, continued to push himself harder and harder. In his rare moments of quiet, he confided that he could no longer sleep for more than a couple of hours without waking up feeling guilty that he was not working on a file. It soon became clear to me that he was being consumed by the hunger for more prestige, more glory, and more money. As expected, Julian became enormously successful. He achieved everything most people could ever want: a stellar professional reputation with an income in seven figures, a spectacular mansion in a neighborhood favored by celebrities, a private jet, a summer home on a tropical island, and his prized possession, a shiny red Ferrari parked in the center of his driveway. Yet I knew that things were not as idyllic as they appeared on the surface. I observed the signs of impending doom, not because I was so much more perceptive than the others at the firm, but simply because I spent the most time with the man. We were always together because we were always at work. Things never seemed to slow down. There was always another blockbuster case on the horizon that was bigger than the last. No amount of preparation was ever enough for Julian. What would happen if the judge brought up this question or that question? God forbid. What would happen if our research was less than perfect? What would happen if he was surprised in the middle of a packed courtroom looking like a deer caught in the glare of an intruding pair of headlights? So we pushed ourselves to the limit, and I got sucked into his little work-centered world as well. There we were, two slaves to the clock, toiling away on the 64th floor of some steel and glass monolith, while most sane people were at home with their families, thinking we had a world by the tail, blinded by an illusory version of success. The more time I spent with Julian, the more I could see that he was driving himself deeper into the ground. It was as if he had some kind of a death wish. Nothing ever satisfied him. Eventually, his marriage failed. He no longer spoke with his father, and though he had every material possession anyone could want, he still had not found whatever it was that he was looking for. It showed emotionally, physically, and spiritually. At 53 years of age, Julian looked as if he was in his late 70s. His face was a mass of wrinkles, a less than glorious tribute to his taken-up prisoners, approach to life in general, and the tremendous stress of his out-of-balance lifestyle in particular. The late-night dinners in expensive French restaurants, smoking thick Cuban cigars, and drinking cognac after cognac had left him embarrassingly overweight. He constantly complained that he was sick and tired of being sick and tired. He had lost sense of humor and never seemed to laugh anymore. Julian's once enthusiastic nature had been replaced by a deathly soberness. Personally, I think that his life had lost all sense of purpose. Perhaps the saddest thing was that he had also lost his focus in the courtroom, where he would once dazzle all those present with an eloquent and airtight closing argument. He now droned on for hours, rambling about obscure cases that had little or no bearing on the matter before the court, where once he would react gracefully to the objections of opposing counsel, he now displayed a biting sarcasm that had severely tested the patience of judges who had earlier viewed him as a legal genius. Simply put, Julian's spark of life had begun to flicker. It wasn't just the strain of his frenetic pace that was marking him for an early grave. I sense it went far deeper. It seemed to be a spiritual thing. Almost every day, he would tell me that he felt no passion for what he was doing and was enveloped by emptiness. Julian said that as a young lawyer, he really loved the law, even though he was initially pushed into it by the social agenda of his family. The law's complexities and intellectual challenges had kept him spellbound and full of energy. Its power to effect social change had inspired and motivated him. Back then, he was more than just some rich kid from Connecticut. He really saw himself as a force for good, an instrument for social improvement who could use his obvious gifts to help others. That vision gave his life meaning. It gave him a purpose, and it fueled his hopes. There was even more to Julian's undoing than a rusty connection to what he did for a living. He had suffered some great tragedy before I had joined the firm. Something truly unspeakable had happened to him, according to one of the senior partners, but I couldn't get anyone to open up about it. Even old man Harding, the notoriously loose-lipped managing partner, spent more time in the bar of the Ritz-Carlton than in his embarrassingly large office, said that he was sworn to secrecy. Whatever this deep, dark secret was, I had a suspicion that it in some way was contributing to Julian's downward spiral. Sure, I was curious, but most of all, I wanted to help him. He was not only my mentor, he was my best friend. And then it happened. this massive heart attack that brought the brilliant Julian Mantle back down to earth and reconnected him to his mortality. Right in the middle of courtroom number 7 on a Monday morning, the same courtroom where we had won the mother of all murder trials. The miraculous transformation of Julian Mantle. I was astonished by a new and improved Julian Mantle. How could someone who looked like a tired old man only a few short years ago now look so vibrant and alive? I wondered in silent disbelief. Was it some magical drug that had allowed him to drink from the fountain of youth? What was the cause of this extraordinary reversal? Julian was the first to speak. He told me that the hyper-competitive legal world had taken its toll on him, not only physically and emotionally, but spiritually. The fast pace and endless demands had worn him out and run him down. He admitted that his body had fallen apart and that his mind had lost its luster. His heart attack was only one symptom of a deeper problem. The constant pressure and exhausting schedule of a world-class trial lawyer had also broken his most important and perhaps most human endowment, his spirit. When given the ultimatum by his doctor, either to give up the law or give up his life, he said he saw a golden opportunity to rekindle the inner fire he had known when he was younger, a fire that had been extinguished as the law had become less a pleasure and more a business. Julian grew visibly excited as he recounted how he sold all his material possessions and headed for India, a land whose ancient culture and mystical traditions had always fascinated him. He traveled from tiny village to tiny village, sometimes by foot, sometimes by train, learning new customs, seeing the timeless sights and growing to love the Indian people. Radiated warmth, kindness, and refreshing perspective on the true meaning of life. Even those who had very little opened their homes and their hearts to this weary visitor from the West, as the days melted into weeks within this enchanting environment, Julian slowly began to feel alive and whole again, perhaps for the first time since he was a child. His natural curiosity and creative spark steadily returned, along with his enthusiasm and his energy for living. He started to feel more joyful and peaceful, and he began to laugh again. Although he embraced every moment of his time in his exotic land, Julian told me that this journey to India was more than a simple vacation to ease an overworked mind. He described his time in this faraway land as a personal odyssey of the self. He confided that he was determined to find out who he really was and what his life was all about before it was too late. To do this, his first priority was to connect to the culture's vast pool of ancient wisdom on living a more rewarding, fulfilling, and enlightened life. I don't mean to sound too off the wall, John, but it was like I had received a command from within, an inner instruction telling me that I was to begin a spiritual voyage to rekindle the spark that I had lost, said Julian. It was tremendously liberating time for me. The more he explored, the more he heard of Indian monks who had lived beyond the age of 100, Monks who, despite their advanced years, maintain youthful, energetic, and vital lives. The more he traveled, the more he learned of ageless yogis who had mastered the art of mind control and spiritual awakening. And the more he saw, the more he longed to understand the dynamics behind these miracles of human nature, hoping to apply their philosophies to his own life. During the early stages of his journey, Julian sought out many well-known and highly respected teachers. He told me that each one of them welcomed him with open arms and open hearts, sharing whatever gems of knowledge they had absorbed over lifetime spent in quiet contemplation on the loftier issues surrounding their existence. Julian also attempted to describe the beauty of the ancient temples which were strewn across the mystical landscape of India, edifices which stood as loyal gatekeepers to the wisdom of the ages. He said he was moved by the sacredness of these surroundings. "It was a very magical time of my life, John. Here I was, a tired old litigator who had sold everything from my racehorse to my Rolex and had packed all that remained into a large rucksack that would be the constant companion as I ventured into the timeless traditions of the East. Was it hard to leave? I wondered aloud, unable to contain my curiosity. Actually, it was the easiest thing I have ever done. The decision to give up my practice and all my worldly possessions felt natural." Albert Camus once said that real generosity toward the future consists in giving all to what is present. Well, that is exactly what I did. I knew I had to change, so I decided to listen to my heart and do it in a very dramatic way. My life became so much simpler and meaningful when I left the baggage of my past behind. The moment I stopped spending so much time chasing the big pleasures of life and began to enjoy the little ones, like watching the stars dancing in the moonlight sky or soaking into the sunbeams of a glorious summer morning. And in India is such an intellectually stimulating place that I rarely thought of all I had left. Those initial meetings with the learned and the scholarly of the exotic culture, though intriguing, did not yield the knowledge for which Julian hungered, the wisdom that he desired, and the practical techniques that he hoped would change the quality of his life continued to elude him in those early days of his odyssey. It was not until Julian had been in India for about 7 months that he had his first real break. It was while he was in Kashmir, an ancient and mystical state that sits sleepily at the foot of the Himalayas, that he had a good fortune to meet a gentleman named Yogi Krishnan. This slight man with a clean-shaven head had also been a lawyer in his previous incarnation, as he often joked with a toothy grin. Fed up with the hectic pace that personifies modern New Delhi, he too gave up his material possessions and retreated to a world of greater simplicity. Becoming a caretaker of the village temple, Krishnan said he had come to know himself and his purpose in the larger scheme of life. "I was tired of living my life like one long air raid drill. I realized that my mission is to serve others and somehow to contribute to making this world a better place. Now I live to give," he told Julian. "I spend my days and nights at this temple, living an austere but fulfilling life. I share my realizations with all those who come here to pray. I serve those in need. I am not a priest. I am simply a man who has found his soul." Julian informed this lawyer-turned-yogi of his own story. He spoke of his former life of prominence and privilege. He told Yogi Krishnan of his hunger for wealth and his obsession with work. He revealed with great emotion his inner turmoil and the crisis of spirit he had experienced when the once bright light of his life began to flicker in the winds of an out-of-balance lifestyle. I too have walked this path, my friend. I too have felt the pain you have felt. Yet I have learned that everything happens for a reason, offered Yogi Krishnan sympathetically. Every event has a purpose, and every setback its lesson. I have realized that failure, whether of the personal, professional, or even spiritual kind, is essential to personal expansion. It brings inner growth and a whole host of psychic rewards. Never regret your past. Rather, embrace it as a teacher that it is. After hearing these words, Julian told me that he felt great exaltation. Perhaps, in Yogi Krishnan, he had found the mentor he was searching for. Who better than another former hotshot lawyer who, through his own spiritual odyssey, had found a better way of living to teach him the secrets of creating a life of more balance, enchantment, and delight? I need your help, Krishnan. I need to learn how to build a richer, fuller life. I would be honored to assist you in the way that I can, offered the yogi. But may I give you one suggestion?
Sure.
For as long as I have been caring for the temple in this little village, I've heard whisperings of a mystical band of sages living high in the Himalayas. Legend has it that they have discovered some sort of system that will profoundly improve the quality of anyone's life. And I don't just mean physically. It is supposed to be holistic, integrated set of ageless principles and timeless techniques to liberate the potential of the mind, body, and soul. Julian was fascinated. This seemed perfect. Just exactly where do these monks live? No one knows. And I regret that I'm too old to start searching. But I will tell you one thing, my friend. Many have tried to find them, and many have failed, with tragic consequences. The higher reaches of the Himalayas are treacherous beyond compare. Even the most skilled climber is rendered helpless against their natural ravages. But if it is the golden keys ready on health, lasting happiness, and inner fulfillment that you are searching for, I do not have the wisdom you seek. They do. Julian, never want to give up easily. Press Yogi Krishnan again. Are you certain that you have no idea where they live? All I can tell you is that the locals in this village know them as the great sages of Sivana. Their mythology, Sivana means oasis of enlightenment. These monks are revered as if they are divine in their constitution and influence. If I know where they could be found, I would be duty bound to tell you. But honestly, I do not know. No one does, for that matter. The next morning, as the first rays of Indian sun danced along the colorful horizon, Julian set out on his trek to the lost land of Sivana. At first, he thought about hiring a Sherpa guide to aid him in the climb through the mountains, but for some strange reason, his instincts told him that this wasn't a journey he would have to make alone. So instead, for perhaps the first time in his life, he shed the shackles of reason and placed his trust in his intuition. He felt he would be safe. He somehow knew he would find what he was looking for. So, with missionary zeal, he started to climb. The first few days were easy. Sometimes he would catch up to one of the cheerful citizens of the village below who happened to be walking on one of the footpaths, perhaps searching for just the right piece of wood for a carving or seeking the sanctuary that this surreal place offered to all those who dared to venture this high into the heavens. At times he hiked alone. using this time to silently reflect on where he had been in his life and where he was now headed. Did it take long before the village below was nothing more than a tiny speck on his marvelous canvas of natural splendor? The majesty of the snow-capped peaks of the Himalayas made his heart beat faster, and for one long moment took his breath away. He felt a oneness with his surroundings, a kind of kinship that two old friends might enjoy after many years spent listening to each other's innermost thoughts and laughing at each other's jokes. The fresh mountain air cleared his mind and energized his spirit. Having traveled the world many times over, Julian had thought he had seen it all, but he had never seen beauty like this. The wonders of which he drank at a magical time were an exquisite tribute to the symphony of nature. At once, he felt joyous, exhilarated, and carefree. It was here, high above the humanity below, that Julian slowly ventured out of the cocoon of the ordinary and began to explore the realm of the extraordinary. "I still remember the words that were going through my mind up there," said Julian. "I thought that ultimately life is all about choices. One's destiny unfolds according to the choice one makes. And I felt certain that the choice I had made was the right one." I knew my life would never be the same, and that something marvelous, maybe even miraculous, was about to happen to me. It was an amazing awakening. As Julian climbed into the rarefied regions of the Himalayas, he told me that he grew anxious. It was those good kind of jitters, like the ones I had on prom night right before an exciting case began, and the media was chasing me up the courtroom steps. And even though I didn't have the benefit of a guide or a map, the way was clear and a thin, lightly traveled path led me higher into the deepest reaches of those mountains. It was like I had some sort of inner compass, nudging me gently towards my destination. I don't think I could have stopped climbing even if I had wanted to. Julian was excited, his words spilling out like a gushing mountain stream after rains. As he traveled for two more days along the road that he had prayed would take him to Savannah, Julian's thoughts wandered back to his former life. Though he felt entirely liberated from the stress and strain that personified his former world, he did wonder whether he could really spend the rest of his days without intellectual challenge the legal profession had offered him since he left Harvard Law School. His thoughts then wandered back to his oak panel office in a glittering downtown skyscraper and the idyllic summer home he had sold for a pittance. He thought about his old friends with whom he would frequent the finest of restaurants in the most glamorous locales. He also thought about his prized Ferrari and how his heart would soar when he gunned the engine and his oldest ferocity sprang to life with a roar. As he ventured deeper into the depths of this mystical place, his reflections of the past were quickly interrupted by the stunning marvels of the moment. It was while he was soaking in the gifts of nature's intelligence that something startling happened. From the corner of his eye, he saw another figure, dressed strangely in a long, flowing red robe, topped by a dark blue hood, slightly ahead of him on the path.